Before we get started with today's show, I want to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, Fantasy Focus Football. They tape every morning, Monday through Friday, live on Twitter. Be sure to check it out if you're interested in the very best analysis in the game, or if you're just ashamed of how your team is performing and want to live vicariously through others. Also, the Peabody and Emmy Award-winning 30 for 30 film series presents Once Upon a Time in Queens, a four-part documentary event about the city, the swagger, and the wild ride of the 1986 Mets. This documentary explores the epic tale of one of baseball's most dominant and iconoclastic teams and their legendary World Series comeback. Hear from former Mets players and fans, including Daryl Strawberry, Keith Hernandez, Bill Burr, Cindy Lauper, and more. All four parts of Once Upon a Time in Queens are available to stream on ESPN Plus and the ESPN app immediately. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, we are going to talk to Seth Wickersham, the author of Is Better to Be Feared, a great new book on the New England Patriots dynasty. But first, it is Fox Word Friday. Dominique Foxworth, what's going on?
What's up, man? You gave us a scare. I'm thinking that you gone Foxworth Friday. You got a couple Fridays left, maybe, and apparently you back and you not back at the same time.
Dog, what's so wild about that is I didn't give nobody a scare. I didn't even think that the stuff that came out was that terrifying, right? Like, I had a contract that was set to expire at the end of March. It was reported my contract expires at the end of March, and I might not come back. Which to me, by the way, seems like this kind of self-evident thing that happens when somebody has a contract, and the contract might expire, right? So this goes up. Next thing I know, man, I'm looking around, and everybody's like, oh, man, ESPN gonna lose Bomani. Oh, damn, Bomani gonna go. So you got, like, the haters and our good friends, the racist, who are just like, ah, yes, finally, you know, and all this stuff. And then everybody else throwing flowers on the grave. And I'm like, huh, isn't this interesting? Meanwhile, that is all completely separate from the fact that we got this HBO thing that was coming up. Like, those two things literally have nothing to do with each other. It's not some, like, con or something like that where it's like, yo, get your name out there so that then this other thing will come up and everybody talk about it. It wasn't anything like that. It was just like, okay, so this one thing has popped up. Okay, this other thing is coming. Like, okay. And I got to say, I can't imagine what it might have been like for people if they think they're about to hear that I'm out of here. And I say, I got an announcement to make. And it's like, well, I am going to do something out of here.
Yeah.
But I am not out of here as of yet.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it also feels like success and failure. And people who, like, you get attached to somebody that you're a fan of or somebody you like to listen to. And your fans go back a real long way. Some of them feel like real friends to you.
Yes.
You know, like, so having your contract expire and not coming back feels like a loss, even though in this current media climate, if you're talented, there's going to be somewhere for you to land. And if you're really, really talented, that place going to be HBO.
This is an interesting thing about working here, which is every day we get on television and we talk about other people's money, right? Every day we talk about other people's contracts and we cold about it too, right? Yeah. Like, somebody's getting a pay cut. Hey, man. You know, salary cap is just kind of what it is. That guy's getting old, right? Like, you cost too much and they got to trade you because of that. Hey, man, that's just what it is. But anytime the business comes and affects us, all of a sudden everybody turned into a goddamn human being, right? All of a sudden everybody is like, oh, man, you know how they treated you and da-da-da and everything else. Dog, I have worked at this company in various capacities for 17 years. Like, I think that's the part that people don't get. I started freelancing with ESPN in 2004. There was a stretch from, like, in 2008 and 2009 where I wasn't working here. But basically, every other time from 2004 until now, I've worked here in some form or fashion, right? Not always the way I want it, you know, but in some form or fashion, I have worked here. And anything I get, honestly, after this is a byproduct of the fact that I worked here, right? Like, no matter how mad they might make me sometimes at points or how mad I may make them or whatever it is, in the end, I have built a life and a career that has allowed me to, like, legitimately impact people through this industry and through this work. And the biggest part of why is here. Like, it's because right. I work here. That's something you can never forget about this. And so if I woke up one day and this has happened. I woke up one day and they were like, yo, we're not going to pay you as much money as we used to. Okay, right? You go from paying me, whoo, that's a lot of money too. That's a lot of money. Okay, you know, still a good life. It's like still nothing to it. But if it ended in March or it ended tomorrow, I ain't going to be salty about it, right? You know, had a TV show. Yeah. The TV show got canceled. Nobody quite knew what to figure out or how to do with it. That's not personal. That's life. Mm-hmm. They changed the way they do things. That's what it is. But I've been good with them, and they've been good with me through the entirety of this. So, like, for me, this is cool. And the HBO thing, I guess we have to spell out what's going on here.
Oh.
I will be hosting a show on HBO called Game Theory. It will be executive produced by my man Seth Whiteberg, my man Stu Miller, Todd Shulman, and Adam McKay, who you may be familiar with, right? So I'm set up, right? I got cast that work with, like, Sacha Baron Cohen on the Borat movies. We got a dude who was the director of the field department for The Daily Show for over a decade. And Adam McKay, who might be, like, the most brilliant person I've come across in this game in doing this. My man Seth worked on Patriot Act and a few other things. And so what we're looking at there is think kind of like, not exactly the same as these, obviously, but think of something in the realm of like Daily Show, John Oliver type stuff, except we're going to talk about sports.
Yeah.
And so what we're going to try to do is, and this is what we talk about all the time when we worked on this, the vibe that we have here on this here podcast, how do we carry that over to television? But it's going to be like a writing room and stuff like that. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like there's a real live full staff that's involved with this.
That's exciting.
This is like the thing that I've always wanted to do. Like, if you're like, well, you know, if you could do anything in the world, what would it be? It would be this kind of thing. And so we're doing this and also going to continue doing the right time.
Yeah, it's perfect. I don't know that we talked about this last time, talking about how different people take the cancellation of your TV show and how some people were like, oh my gosh. And you kind of the whole time was like, but I had a TV show. But like all that stuff was a springboard to this. And it feels like this is it. This is the thing. I can't imagine that there's anything anybody in this business, anybody anywhere close to entertainment would want more than a show at HBO built around them. Like that's incredible. Like I'm looking forward to it. I expect it will succeed, but either way, you're gonna have a show on HBO.
Right. That's what I'm saying.
That's like nuts, man.
Like the end of High Noon for me, it wasn't professionally devastating. There were personal levels that it was devastating. There were relationships that I had with people that like aren't the same as they were before. Like that's the real disappointment. I ain't gonna lie. I told people this before. I never entertained or considered the possibility that you could do a TV show with me and it not work. Like walking in the door on that, I was like, okay, well, we got me. We'll get the rest right, you know? Yeah. And we didn't get it right. We didn't get it wrong either. Like, I think that part is important to note, right? Like, we didn't get it wrong, but nah, we didn't get it right either. But it happens. You know what I'm saying? Like that's just one of those things. It goes down and it happens. And so then I came back here and, you know, last year and a half, man, I've done a lot. Like we did the YouTube series. We've taken this. We've expanded it. I did the TV stuff, some outside stuff I got to do, doing the Costas thing, writing stuff for Vanity Fair, you know, all of that. Like for me, after that happened, and then it was right at quarantine, right? So like right when the quarantine hit, this all happened. Because I always tell people that we were trying to figure out my contract with quarantine when we were figuring out what it was. And they said word that they had shut down the seaport. And I called my agent and said, take the last offer. I ain't even asked what the number was. Take the last offer. Yeah. You ain't got to fight them over it. You ain't got to squeeze. Let's get this money before they change their minds, right?
Oh, yeah. Everybody, I was negotiating during that time, too. It was not a fun time. Like, I'm doing more and more stuff on TV. I'm like, all right, we about to get it. And then that virus get over here, and they start cutting people, making all types of decisions. We had no leverage at that point.
None. I was just like, thank you, guys. Like, that's one thing about it. I don't know what they would have had to do to me in the last 2 years for me to not be like, thank you for that two-year deal, right?
Yeah,
like,
right.
Like, because that's what I thought. We were just going to be locked down for a couple months.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
It changed.
So Game Theory, look out for that. And again, we're going to be right back here doing this thing, which I have like legitimately come to love. Like I really love doing this. I guess me and Gabe have been doing this now for 3 years, right? The relationship and the not just professionally, but personally, that we've developed in the course of doing this. Like, this has been a real good time. And this is all good stuff. And that's why, like, for me, it's just wild working here. And this is the only place where this happens. Working here is the only place where people talk about your contract like you play ball.
Yeah.
You know, there's bigger networks. You know, like, you might know what somebody at Fox News makes or MSNBC or CNN, whatever it is. But ain't nobody really looking at the personnel market. I mean, I think it's a byproduct of the fact that we look at personnel markets like that. And so people then bring that back on us. So it's the wildest thing in the world to me that anybody would ever care about whether or not I'm going to stay somewhere or go somewhere or whatever it is. And this be like legitimate news to people. That's so wild. Like, news. And then, you know, everybody that covers sports media, not everybody, but a whole lot of them. And then I'm like, wow, y'all don't know nothing at all. Don't even bother to call me.
Yeah. I mean, also, I think what you represent, which is funny because you've come to represent this to people, even though it's not always, I guess, completely fair. I think you've come to represent like a progressive voice, which I guess you are in some respect. But like, your sports analysis is like second to none. So like, I think people put so much more on what happens with you, especially given other things that are happening around this network at the same time, is there are people who are like, oh, we won. Like, Bobani's right. out. We won. It's like, well, nobody really wins when you have someone who has a unique perspective. So like, you can't replace that. I think that's one thing that I remember Dan saying about you a long time ago that I've come to see also. Is like, there are some, and I mean, I experienced it too. There's some ways that you look at things and then I'm like, oh man, I was wrong. And like, that rarely happens, you know, and it's a different perspective. Like, oh, damn, wish I thought of that. I think that happens to when I'm listening or reading certain people, but I don't think it happens as often when I'm listening to anybody except for you, which is like, if it's gone, that ain't good for nobody.
Nah. Well, I think you mentioned something that I do find, I don't know the word to use, but I've always talked about sports.
Right.
Like, one thing I'm always very aware of, and this is key. This ain't my house. I just got a room in it. And I got to keep my room clean and everything else, but I can put the posters on the wall that I want to. But if I put a poster on the wall that's out of hand, mama going to come in and rip that poster down off the wall, right? I ain't going to put no naked girl up on the wall because mama going to come in and be like, what are you doing, right? Uh-huh. You know, douse the room with holy water and hope that everything works out okay. Like, that's what it is. But it's always sports. Like, you know, this podcast, we meander and go in different places, but I'm always down to talk about sports. Like, the one thing that has amazed me about doing this for like 20 years almost is I still really, really enjoy sports. Like, I like watching them. I like talking about them. And now that we get more like kind of off the wall, personal sort of stories, like, it lets me put the degrees to work sometimes. But I really, really like talking about sports and the people who are around them. Like, the thing I hate, like, I miss the most in quarantine is honestly just being at the seaport and ain't no telling who's going to show up. Like, you post it up and then next thing you know, Magic Johnson is coming through and dapping you up. You know what I mean? Like, those kinds of things. Like, I still love this. Yeah. And so, hey, man, I'm just glad I'm going to be able to, like, do it in a different way than had been done before.
I remember when Jadakiss popped up at the seaport. I was there. Like, oh, Jada.
Yes.
It was just like just random people coming up in there. What's the name from Peloton? Just people that you just like, you working? Then
yes.
Just a random Wednesday. And like Matthew McConaughey is in the seaport. They're like, oh, hey. And the craziest part, I think, is you talked about earlier how influential this network is and how ubiquitous it is. It's like, I don't consider myself a celebrity, but it is weird as hell when celebrities come up to me and want to talk to. I remember I was at the ESPYs and Anthony Mackie just came up and started talking to me about my takes. And I'm like, oh, I'm walking past Anthony Mackie, like not thinking nothing of it. And we make eye contact. I just give him a head like a regular, what up, brother? Head nod that you give to all black people. He's preparing to do the ESPYs. He's preparing to host the ESPYs. And he like runs over the little light jog and want to talk about how he played safety in high school and talk about how he thinks I'm the smartest man at ESPN. I'm like, damn, I forget. It's not just me walking through the streets and like a 40-year-old black man, because that's really mostly 40-year-old black man just yell, hey, ESPN. It's like,
you ain't got no name. Your name ain't ESPN. No name, or your name could be some other dude on ESPN. Like, I don't know how many people gonna call you Ryan Clark by the time it's all over, right? It ain't because y'all look alike. Is y'all being like, y'all being like similar places. But I remember one of the highlights of my life, we had Bo Jackson on Highly Questionable once. and that's my OG. That's my number one. Like, I mean, his name was Bo, right? On top of that. Yeah. And then it was the whole, he can do everything. Like, I remember I had the poster. Some of y'all probably remember this. It was the, like, it was the Bo Knows poster, the long joint that had him in all the different things. So, like, in a basketball outfit, a football outfit, a baseball outfit, golf, like, all the way across the board. And, like, when I was little, people would ask me what you want to be when you grow up. And I would say a jack of all trades. I thought I could do everything. I wanted to do everything. And Bo Jackson was, like, kind of the living embodiment of that. And I remember in 2012, 30 for 30 called You Don't Know Bo. My man Dave O'Connor, executive produced it. And I was in that, and I came up to New York for the premiere because I thought Bo was going to be there, and he wasn't, and I was very disappointed, but it was okay. And so now we fast forward a couple of years. We're doing Highly Questionable. Bo Jackson's there, and I ain't say nothing. He just looked up and said, Mr. Jones, how are you? I can quit, dog. Yeah, I can quit this whole thing, man. I don't need to do nothing else in this world. Bo Jackson knows who I am.
That's amazing, because I think that you, of all people, I don't think of in that way. Like, I know you well enough to know that there are some things and some people that you, like, really get excited about. But just, like, you sound like a real legit fan. Like, the fans that you be roasting about taking this stuff too seriously, if it's the right person or the right team or the right moment, Bo Monty Jones himself might melt.
You're damn right. You're damn right. I'm going to do it for Bo Jackson. I ain't going to do it for the Falcons. You know what I'm saying? Like, yes. Yes, I will absolutely Kirk out fanboy. Like, it's interesting watching people fanboy. So I did Costas. We had Ken Burns on the last episode. And we also had Damaris Smith. He was on our panel. And before it came up, somebody told us, they're like, hey, told Ken Burns, you know, just to let you know, you're going to see Damaris Smith and he's going to have something to say to you. And I ain't know if Damaris Smith had a problem with something Ken Burns had done. Mm-hmm. Dude, Damaris Smith walked in there. Oh, yeah. You would have thought he was meeting Michael Jackson, man. He was just like, just, I love your work. And he's like, I think he got an autograph, just everything. And it was just like plaintive and submissive and everything. Like, it's always, we all got it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
We all got somebody. But let me ask you this. Is anybody in Jacksonville doing that when they see Urban Meyer? He got any fans over there?
They did when they hired him. And then from then on, he just chipped away at whatever goodwill he had. And this last one, the funny thing about this last one to me is, like, it wasn't a big deal. And I know that maybe there's some moral police out there who are going to be like, but his wife, but she's only in her 20s. Like, okay. Like, to me, this is about him not being good at his job. They just was waiting for something to jump on his neck about.
And people not liking him. That's all it came. That was my thought.
If they were winning, it would be a funny story. We'd be laughing about it. But the fact that they're losing, now everyone's like, but his wife, I care so much about his marriage. I'm appalled. The owner said it was inexcusable. What?
Yo, you know what I wonder when I see the owner say something like that? That sound like his wife talking. You know what I mean?
He's sending a message to her. Like, I want you to know I think this is inexcusable.
Look. When the Tiger Woods thing happened, right? When out in 2009, 2009, when all that happened, and all them cats went extra hard at him, I was like, none of you are fooling me. None. Like, Tom Watson was one of those that was at the top of it with the super finger wagging. And it was another case where people were just looking for a reason to jump on the dude, like, especially around the golf world. And then I think it was Sports Bob Brooks that looked it up. The Tom Watson had one of them divorces that you can't get to the bottom of, but it sounded very much as though it ended under similar circumstances. Like, all these cats got to get out there like, yeah, you should never treat your woman like that.
I'm not going to jump into their lives, but, like, we all know somebody. It may not be you. It may be you. But, like, we all know somebody and are cool with people who have done much worse. And, like, not even in their relationships, just done much worse in their life than had a young woman grind on them. And also, like, had it happened in a strip club, no one would care. You'd be like, that's what happens in there.
Right.
And it's fine. He's married. Sometimes married men go to strip club, but then they leave. They're still married. I don't know. It's shocking to me how everybody got on their high horse about this, and how I also know, like, if it were Bill Belichick, if it were Andy Reid, if it was somebody like that,
it'd be funny.
We'd just be cackling because they are great at coaching football.
Yeah. Like, that was the thing. I said that, I mean, again, because it just comes down to the fact that they don't like him. The right person this happens to. He walks into practice and they just laugh at him, right?
Exactly.
They singing some song when he comes in. Like, he walks in the door and there's somebody from the back row. I know, like, this dude is a problem, but this is the appropriate song. Like, he walks in, my mind's telling me no.
Exactly.
Right? Exactly. Like, if they liked him,
yes,
that is what winds up happening. But they didn't respect him from the jump. And that's the, And by the way, you tell me, I said this Wednesday, and I don't think I'm wrong here. Football players are inclined to respect the coach. It's not like the NBA, where you got to come in and win them. In football, it just really helps if you don't lose them.
Yeah, I mean, it's a militaristic kind of hierarchy that we all kind of accept and understand and don't push back against very much. I think you're right about that. But your point about it becoming a joke, I've been in plenty of locker rooms where people have gotten in plenty of trouble for things much worse than what Urban Meyer has done. And if we like them and respect them, then it's a joke. We make fun of it. It may not be appropriate, but it's like you have so much goodwill. You've built up so much goodwill that it buys you something. And again, we all know how that feels when it's somebody you like and respect in your life. They do something stupid. You might get mad, but they're still your people. When they ain't your people, like, you can't wait. You're excited. You jump on it. And that's what it sounds like happened in that locker room or in that building. It's like, nobody mess with that dude. So they was like, oh, yes. We didn't like him before. Now right. We really don't like him. Like, come on.
Yo, think about it. It's like, we didn't even talk about this on the Monday pod because I was just like, okay, this is going to pass. Like, I didn't think it was that big a deal in the first place. And then he messed up and did that press conference and, you know, did the press availability. And if I had to guess, if he hadn't lost the dudes already, like, if there's one thing that's like, this is a man I can't respect, it was one part of that. And you know what I'm going to say, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Bringing up Trevor?
Yep. That was it. Yeah. That was when cats are like, oh, yeah, nah. Trevor Lawrence has got to be there like, bro.
Trevor Lawrence has a spotless reputation. He even said the right things during the George Floyd time. Like, yes. Everybody ride with Trevor Lawrence, Jesus and everything. He ain't never said nothing wrong. Keep my name out your mouth. Just go ahead and take that charge. You're going to get out. You're going to do a short little bid. Yes. And you're going to get right out and we're going to be cool. Don't be out there incorporating me in your story. I don't want to see my name in a police report. Just shut up.
Yo, and one thing that's interesting about Urban Meyer, because this is always going to fall apart, it seemed clear. I mean, they might as well fire him now, but I understand why they won't. One thing that football-wise, with Urban Meyer at both of his stops, when it started getting shaky was his second set of hires as an assistant, right? So, like, at Florida, Dan Mullen was the offensive coordinator. Everything was cool. Steve Adazio is the offensive coordinator. I don't know about this. That same kind of progression happened at Ohio State with a few of those. He's not good at rehiring assistants. In the NFL, he did a questionable job of hiring assistants in the first place. Yeah. Like, you've got this futuristic quarterback, and you went and hired Darrell Bevell as your offensive coordinator. Not a bad offensive coordinator, but not for the 2021 version of Trevor Lawrence. That right there, my brother, not a great idea. So he was already at the point where he was starting to make the mistakes that it normally took him a while to ultimately make. And then there's everything else, like the Chris Doyle stuff and all of this. And man, this is going to flame out. I mean, again, we knew it was going to. I thought it might not, because I thought that he would get a grip and realize, no, in the NFL, 8-4 is good. Nope. He couldn't handle losing preseason game.
I think that sometimes they believe the stuff that they say. And like, some of that stuff is like, we got to win every day. We got to practice like we play. Everything is important. Nah, you say that stuff, but we all understand preseason's not important. And we don't got to win every day. Sometimes we got to be smart. Sometimes we're tired. And the best thing to do is not try to get better today. It's to get healthier. Like, those are all the things that I think professional coaches, successful ones, start to learn and understand. And normally, it might, even if you make the transition, it might take some time to learn and understand that. But it seemed like he didn't. And your point about the hires is like, I feel like this story is a lot about goodwill to me.
Yeah.
Is all the foolishness that he got caught up with in the other places, foolishness feels like I'm selling it short. But all the problems that he had at his other stops, they didn't come to light until after he was balling.
Mm-hmm.
It's so different. And even those places, it became so big that he had to step away. But here, you can't have this slip up when you haven't built up any goodwill. And you're not even at another college location. You're in a whole nother league. And he just seems ill-prepared for this altogether. So it's a mess.
Nah, man, this is good luck, Herb. Like, that's just my whole thought when I look at it. Good luck, Herb, except the luck is going to be terrible for Herb. And how they supposed to play a game this week? They gonna lose by 100 points.
Yeah, I mean, you there is a scenario where you're like, we rally around our guy, but he ain't their guy. It's the problem. You're not gonna rally around him because he ain't your guy. And they don't have the talent necessarily to overcome any of this stuff. So I tend not to believe in distractions, But I do believe that there's a psychological component that you cannot account for. And it's hard to get hype to play this violent game for somebody with all this stuff going on. Like, they're playing for themselves, but they're also out there like, that extra film study that I normally do? Nah, I'm gonna go ahead and go home.
Well, especially after he was canceling meetings because he didn't want to face everybody.
I don't understand that. Like, if he didn't want to face them, like, what's a better room to face in this situation than a room for the 20-something-year-old men? Like,
I can't. They ain't tripping.
I would walk in and be like, y'all know what happened. You know how. I mean, like, 20-year-old, 20-something-year-old men? And you're like, oh, no, I can't face them. It's not like he had to go talk to a bunch of 50-year-old moms. Like, right. No, that's a different situation. 20-year-old men, you could walk in and be like, hey, you know how it be, guys. And we all would have laughed. I'm telling you, that's the way you handle it in there.
Duh, he should have walked in there like, yo, don't you hate snitches? How you get dialed out at your old restaurant? Like, my first thoughts when I saw that, number one, that salmon quarter zip with the Ohio State logo on it, they should charge $500 for that because only a rich person would buy that, right? Like, yeah. No person that does not have ridiculous levels of disposable income would ever buy such a thing. Okay, we got that. And then, how is somebody sitting over there with a camera filming you? How is there not one person? Because look, if that was Urban's get down, somebody in there knows it's his get down. Like, your guy is supposed to be like, Urban would like to see you in the back room.
I can't imagine that that's the first time that Urban Meyer has done something like that. But when he was the coach at Ohio State, it was a little different.
Right.
I suspect people was looking out for him. Like, if that's his bar, like, he probably feels safe there. And he's not worried about camera phones because he's like, oh, no, these my people. I'm going to put on my Ohio State shirt and remind them how great I made things here. And they're going to look out for me. And if somebody is dancing on me, I know ain't nobody going to post these videos. I don't think he was thinking that that was a problem there.
No, he didn't. And then he had to pretend like it was a big deal. You know, he doesn't think it's a big deal. Then he had to get out here and pretend like it's a big deal. And his wife is on Twitter liking tweets about how she shouldn't have to put up with this. Yo! Like, this has been the worst year ever for him. Because the thing with the Zach Smith stuff was he had the contract on his side. He knew he was going to get through. Like, I think that fundamentally he knew it. And sadly, people were down to let that ride. They were only going to jump back up on it now when you're not losing. And the truth is, as a college football coach, that dude has never lost. Like, he had that one bad year at Florida, and he bailed immediately after that. I told you, he like Magic Johnson. Everybody talk about Magic Johnson did that terrible talk show. Magic Johnson did that talk show for 1 month. It was like, no, this isn't it. Magic's his second year went bad for a couple of games. He was ready to retire and wanted to be traded. Magic was a coach for 1 month. It didn't go well. Magic was out of here. Magic was a GM for a couple of years and then showed up at work one day and was like, hey, I ain't told my boss yet, but I'm out. He does not do difficult things.
That clip is amazing. And why should he? I mean, I understand the point when people are like, why would Urban go back to coaching? Like, he's young. Like, you don't want to do nothing. Right. I understand that. But I also get the point where it's like, he is dodged. And maybe dodge is not the right word, but he's managed to maintain a reputation of a successful dude despite the fact that he has done some ridiculous things. And right. Like, it feels like, why go back? Why go back? You got so close to being like a pariah. Why go back and then act like this? And now it feels like we're not going to, it feels like this is more part of his legacy. Like, this yes. amplifies all the other issues that he's had because his last job is going to be this, like, unless he wants to go to the bottom of college football and work his way back up, because no big school, I think I heard you say this, like, no big school is going to hire Urban after this. So, like, his legacy is going to be 50-50 great coach, 50-50 really bad decision maker.
Yeah, he went back to coaching for the reason that Magic Johnson stopped, right?
Yeah.
Magic Johnson, when he left as the GM, the best part is, like, I want to go back to being Magic Johnson, which would have sounded wildly arrogant if it were anybody other than Magic Johnson who had said that. He's like, I want to go back to being Magic Johnson. Urban Meyer went back to coaching because he wanted to go back to being Urban Meyer.
Right.
Because that's where he's somebody. It's just bad for his health, and he doesn't wear coaching very, very well, and you don't get to go pick the best players anymore and all of that stuff. But hey, man, funny story for us.
He tried to go into a room full of foxes and explain to them like they were sheep.
Right. They were were like,
tell them why you was out doing what you was doing. They know. They know.
Now, speaking of knowing, in just a second, we are going to talk to our good friend Seth Wickersham at ESPN the Magazine. He has got a new book out on the New England Patriots that you want to hear about, and we'll talk about that in 3, 2. All right, we got like a Foxworth Friday double feature for you. We have joining us now, he is the author of It's Better to Be Feared. He's also worked for many years with us here at ESPN the Magazine. Anchorage, Alaska's own Seth Wickersham. What's going on, man?
Thank you. Finally, someone knows, you know, where I'm from.
I remember it used to be in your bio on the blog you had on ESPN.com many years ago, because my best friend from college, he went to high school in Anchorage. And I was like, wow, look at this. Somebody else got out. Way to go.
Exactly. Exactly.
Trajan Langdon. That's the only person I know from Anchorage, Alaska.
Oh, and Mario Chalmers. Mario Chalmers.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
He was also from Anchorage. Now, Seth, you have written a new book, It's Better to Be Feared, about the New England Patriots. Just, I mean, it really goes, you know, decades into that. I think a lot of the focus has just been on Belichick, Brady, and the end. But, you know, for those of us who have followed your work in the magazine, I feel like you've been on this beat for a long time. Like, was the plan always for you to get to a point of writing a book on this? Or did you just look up one day and just realize, you know, I've got a great book here?
I never thought about writing a book on them. And then the publisher actually came to me, Live Right Publishing, came to me in late 2019 and asked if it was something that I was interested in doing. And I was like, holy cow, I think I can actually do this. Because, you know, like you said, I first met Tom Brady in November of 2001. We had both graduated from college the same year. He showed up for that meeting in a gray sweatsuit with a backpack. And the backpack was full of beer because he had just lost a Michigan State bet and owed some of his teammates. And it kind of felt like we were the same species at the time. Nobody even thought that he was going to finish the season. And I'll never forget, he said something in that meeting. He said, you know, football's always come really easy to me. And at the time, I'm like, who says that? This guy is a 6th-round pick who's kind of subbing for Drew Bledsoe. But it turns out he knew himself very, very, very well.
Yeah, that's one of the defining themes in this, and always has been fascinating about Tom Brady, even going back to the Drew Henson days, where he was like, what makes you think I'm going to lose my job to him? Like, he, at all these turns, he's just always been like, yeah, it's cool, but I'm going to, like, wind up on top. And now we're all these years down the line, and that actually proved to be the case. And not only that, it seems like the people around him believe it, too.
Absolutely. And he's had some moments where, even if his self-belief is kind of unshakable, the circumstances kind of got to him. And one of those I write about in great detail was a night when he was at Michigan and he was buried on the depth chart. He's decided he's going to transfer to Cal, where he can get on the field quicker. And he goes to Lloyd Carr, Michigan's coach at the time, and he says, I'm going to transfer to Cal. And Lloyd Carr tells him to sleep on it. And after that meeting, he goes and meets with Greg Hardin, who is his counselor, like a therapist in the athletic department. And he says, you know, I can't get on the field. I'm never going to, you know, get out of this situation. I need to play. And what does his counselor do? Does he give him a hug? Does he give him tough love? And Tom Brady at the time called himself, you know, he said that he was a whiner at the time. Instead, what Greg Hardin does is he laughs at him. He starts laughing at the idea that Brady's going to leave. And he's just like, you haven't done bleep here anyway. You want to leave? Go ahead, because no one's going to care. And that really kind of reignited his competitive fire. And the next morning, he came into Lloyd Carr's office. He told him, I'm staying at Michigan, and I'm going to prove to you I'm the best quarterback on the team.
Now, one thing that was interesting, you put it, there's an excerpt on ESPN.com about the 2007 season and just, you know, everything that came from that, the near perfection of it. For you in exploring it, like, how interesting a story was that? Because I remember, I think it was week one when Randy Moss ran by 3 Jets defensive backs to score that touchdown. And we all looked up because we thought Randy Moss was finished at that point. And we all looked up and were like, oh, Brady's never had that. Moss has never had that. And then they run through this regular season to lose 17-14 in the Super Bowl.
It's crazy. And with the Patriots, they were so dominant for so long. There are all these rabbit holes you could go down that could almost be their own book. And 2007 is one of those, because remember, it was not only the season that Brady finally got all these offensive weapons, but it was also the season that Spygate happened. And it was also the year that he really started dating Giselle and his fame, you know, exploded to a next level. And so really, I looked at 2007 like it began when they started acquiring all those weapons like Moss and Welker. And then Spygate hit. Then the undefeated season almost happens. And there's some, you know, great color in the book from Belichick about some of his motivational techniques. I don't think that the words are appropriate for this podcast, but they're just some really funny moments about how he tried to keep that team on edge, even though they were just blowing out opponents. And then to me, it kind of ended, not when the Super Bowl did, that heartbreaking Super Bowl with the David Tyree catch, but it really ended 6 months later when the congressional Spygate investigation finally shut down. And so I found that season fascinating, and I really made it a centerpiece of the book and something I wanted to go deep on.
Yeah, you know, you bring up Belichick here, and Belichick is very interesting to me because he is a real person. He is a real person who has real people emotions and actual social skills and knows how to dress in public when he's supposed to. And he just gives us absolutely none of that. And you got access to actual real live Bill Belichick. So how was that for you in going into this project, knowing he doesn't want to give us too much, but he had to look at something like this, like, ah, well, you know, we have been doing this for 20 years.
Well, he didn't cooperate for the book, but I drew on a lot of moments where I had talked to him over the years. And I'll give you, you know, just one little for instance. I don't write long about it, but I do write about his relationship with the press and how he kind of navigates things. And it's a more nuanced relationship than a lot of people think. And there was one moment where I was sitting down with him. It was at the owners meetings, and I think it was down in Florida. And I was asking him about how he assembles his draft board. And he was staring at the ground and he was breathing hard out of his nose. And my questions were missing right and left. And he was barely masking his irritation. And anyone who's interviewed Belichick knows what it's like. You've lost him. There's no chance to get him back. It's awkward. And nobody can tolerate awkward silences quite like Belichick. So after like 15 minutes, I got up to leave and I thanked him for his time. And he just started talking. Just talking. Like he knew what I was trying to get at, even if my questions weren't quite getting there. And he ended up going on for another 5 or so minutes and telling all these great stories and being like incredibly helpful about this topic that clearly I wasn't able to get out of him, but he understood what I was trying to achieve.
The relationship between Belichick and Brady is an interesting one. And I think the father-son analogy is probably a good one to make because Tom kind of grew up inside that organization. So I want to hear what you thought about or how you would describe the riff or whatever you call it, clash of philosophies that ended with Brady essentially wanting out.
Things really started to change in 2017. They had just beaten the Falcons in the Super Bowl, their fifth Super Bowl together. And I think that Brady wanted to do some things other than just be known as the New England Patriots quarterback. His TB12 business, he released the book, he did the Tom versus Time documentary. And at the same time, you had Bill, who was deeply invested in Jimmy Garoppolo, who was sitting there behind Brady waiting for his chance. And, you know, Alex Guerrero, Tom Brady's business partner and body coach, was becoming a problem in the building. And Belichick ended up curtailing his access famously that year. So there was just a lot of problems. And on top of it all, Brady wanted to play football until he was age 45 and felt like he deserved a contract as a show of faith that he could get there. And at the end of the day, the Patriots as an organization, and Robert Kraft was part of this, not just Bill Belichick, were just never comfortable guaranteeing a contract for Tom Brady to play until he was age 45. And so even now, if Brady and Bill were in a good place, they met for 20 minutes after the game, you know, there were some hard times there. And you think about how much different life is for Brady in Tampa, where he's not only the quarterback, but he's kind of a pseudo executive. Alex Guerrero has an office at the Tampa Bay Bucks building. He got a Super Bowl ring. This is someone that Belichick essentially banned from most of the team. I think that Brady wanted to take all of the years that he had, this astute football mind. I mean, he knows more about offensive football than most coaches in the league, and be able to use it in a way that he was just never going to be able to do in New England, even if his status in New England was obviously special. I have this moment in the book where Bruce Arians is on the phone with Brady and he's trying to sell Brady on the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And he, you know, says that he always gives his quarterbacks a lot of leniency. And then he also says, and plus, you're Tom Brady. Think about, you know, Tom Brady had won 6 Super Bowls at that point, and he had probably never heard that from his head coach. You're Tom Brady. You get treated differently.
Yeah, but you know, Dominique, you always talk about this. The quarterback always think they're different, right? Until all of a sudden they find out that they're not. And that's what happened with Belichick. They sent Richard Seymour out of there a year early. They, you know, that was always the program. And it became, I think, like a philosophical question for Belichick. Even if this guy's different, is he different? And like so different that we can just keep doing this when you turn 75 years old or, you know, however it goes. And I want to ask you this about Belichick and philosophy, because I think about Tom Landry and the things that you read about him, where people who played for Tom Landry love Tom Landry, but there was a conscious distance between them. Belichick, his approach in dealing with players, that I've never had a great handle on, is like what he thinks is appropriate and how close you can and cannot get. Because there are stories of him doing really nice things for people, like Dante Stallworth tells a story about, we're going to release you to make sure you can go get a job, you know, that kind of thing, or, you know, something to do with like how the pension rolled over or whatever. But dealing with Tom Brady, it felt like he wasn't personal enough.
Well, they're different personalities, but I do think that when Belichick was, you know, he started in the NFL when he was 24, 25 years old. And so he was always the young guy. And when he was first starting to coach, he was the same age, if not younger, than a lot of his players. And I think that he realized that he just could not be their friend. And when he was with the Giants, you know, before they started winning Super Bowls, the players kind of disregarded him to an extent. I mean, he would say, you guys need to go lift weights, and they wouldn't go. And George Martin has talked about it, where they saw him as someone who got his job because of his dad, and they didn't necessarily respect him. And he changed, and Parcells changed, where they realized that the way to get the most out of that team was not to be friends with the players, but to instead be kind of an a-hole. And if they're mad at him, that's okay, because we're going to win games and that's what we've got to do. And it was something that his dad, Steve Belichick, was unafraid to be when he was a coach. And Bill kind of just ended up taking it to the nth degree in New England, where I write about it a lot during that 2007 season, where, you know, losses often reset a team. But because they weren't losing games that year, wins had to serve as losses. And he had to make sure that there was a healthy amount of friction in that building. And if he was the person it was directed toward, he was okay with that.
Friction is important, too. I was wondering, and it just hit me while we're talking, is we talk so much, or at least I think so much, about how Tom Brady has changed, or at least the Tom Brady we know has changed. I have to imagine winning that first Super Bowl for Bill Belichick and then winning five more and going to nine. Like, he had to change too. His relationship to the players had to change. His opinion of himself had to change. Is there anything in the book that talks about who Bill Belichick became, or is it just he changed in that Giants, while he was with the Giants, he changed, and that's kind of been the guy he's been ever since?
I mean, that's the guy. He has changed in ways. I'll give you one example, and it's a small one, but they thought it was important. So he famously released Bernie Kosar and kind of knocked him on the way out. You know, I think the famous phrase was, you know, we see a clear diminishing of skills. And when Bledsoe got hurt and Brady takes over, you can tell that Bill had already had his doubts about Bledsoe. He thought that Bledsoe didn't play as fast as he needed to be, and that he wasn't as accurate throwing to his left. And he had thought about benching Bledsoe even before he got hurt. So he decides to stick with Brady. And when he does that and he tries to explain the decision, he goes out of his way to compliment Drew Bledsoe and to actually not level with the press, but instead, you know, make it seem less personal. And even though it was a small thing, there was people in the building who saw a degree of evolution there, because they were like, here he had this chance. He is this player that he has severe reservations about. But, you know, he went out and complimented him and didn't make it as personal as it was with Bernie Kosar.
Well, he also has the next inflection point, which I think there are two moments where people thought that this thing had ended, right? One of them, obviously, the Monday night game, I want to say week 4, 2014 against Kansas City, where it all looked like it was falling apart. And it was reasonable to think Tom Brady was finished 7 years ago. But the other, releasing Lawyer Malloy before the 2003 season and then going out and getting the brakes beat off him by Buffalo in week 1, and then they won the first of consecutive Super Bowls. Like, that was the one I always wondered, because from the outside, we are all, hey, that's how you lose a team. That's how you lose a team. How did he not?
Yeah, I think that Belichick is always able to go back to his reservoir of knowledge and make the players feel like that he's putting them in the best chance to be successful. I think that he's always good at that. But yeah, they lost that Buffalo game. And in that game, I write about how Brady missed a receiver open. He had a receiver uncovered at the goal line and didn't even look at him. And the coaches were kind of like, where is this guy's head? A couple weeks later, he has a chance to pull off a comeback against Washington, doesn't get it done. And his dad is calling him. And his dad is like, Tom, I'm calling to check on you. For days, Brady won't return his dad's call. Finally, his dad leaves a message and he says, you know, there aren't any bridges in Boston high enough to jump off. And Brady calls him back immediately and he says, you know exactly how I feel. And they didn't lose again until the next season.
That was what I was thinking. Like, in that time frame, there's like an 18-game winning streak or something absurd like that.
We think of Belichick as like never making mistakes, the perfect football mind, except for this Brady decision. Is there anything else that you have that like Belichick did the wrong thing, made the wrong decision from a football standpoint.
Well, he does them all the time. I mean, he says, you know, we're all going to make mistakes and nobody makes them more than me. I think one of the most interesting themes about Bill is the psychological exercise and how he seemed, you know, for someone who often seems like an introvert and maybe not with the highest levels of EQ, he kind of understands his opponents in a psychological way that damages them. You know, he broke Mike Martz in the Super Bowl. The way that he beat Mike Shanahan in 2003 with the intentional safety, that haunted Mike Shanahan. It still irritates him to this day. And I think that there was a moment that really reignited the dynasty that gets overlooked. And it was in 2015 against the Baltimore Ravens in the playoffs. Third quarter, they're down by 14 points against a team that just is not scared of the Patriots at all. And he unveils those famous funky formations, the Baltimore formation and the Raven one, not only knowing that it was going to pose a schematic problem to the Ravens, but knowing that if he went no huddle, John Harbaugh, a great coach, but has a bit of a temper, would get so angry that he might come undone. And sure enough, on the second drive, John Harbaugh got so mad at what the Patriots were doing, he got a 15-yard unsportsmanlike conduct penalty. And so in a matter of minutes, Tom Brady and Bill Belichick had undone a proud team, gotten the crowd back into things, caused the coach to have a meltdown, and tied the game and set what we saw over the next couple years in motion.
Lost my ring right there. Thanks a lot. I was injured on that team. I was about to ride those guys to a Super Bowl ring.
I would have lost my I remember watching that game. And it's just all these dudes in all these different places rubbing their sails up and down and everything else. Like I couldn't blame John Harbaugh for that. What are we going to do? Everybody just out here. And I remember the first time I saw this, and I know we're getting to the end, but this is going to seem almost middle school. I think they were playing the Oilers. This is when I was a kid. And the Browns were supposed to punt. But for some reason, the Oilers had to call a timeout. And so they called the timeout, and they come back out. And it's punt formation. And then next thing you know, the Browns have, like, people are getting into, like, somebody's going under center, right? And they're in a regular formation. And all the Oilers are up. Timeout, timeout, timeout. Except, what can't you do in the NFL on back-to-back plays? Call timeout. And they're just freaking out and losing it. And I was like, oh, this little guy has an idea of what he's doing on these things. I know they'd be wanting to fight him.
I feel like he just peruses the rule book every offseason and just circles stuff. It's like, okay, okay, wait till next season.
All right, now that is Seth Wickersham. Check it out. It's Better to be Feared. His new book on the New England Patriots, Belichick, Brady, Bob Kraft, all of that. Really good. I really highly recommend that you check it out. I was just on the phone with Howard Bryan, and he couldn't stop talking about how good the book was. So, you know, that's a hard audience there, Jack. You have done well with it. Congratulations on getting it done, because I can't imagine how hard it is to do something like that. So forget about anything else for you. Great job even just filing the damn thing.
You guys are great friends. Thank you, guys.
All right, no problem. And ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this three times a week. Gabe Bassain and Dave Presley handling everything behind the scenes. Thank you, gentlemen. Remember, follow The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars, I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. And I'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or follow on the ESPN app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.